Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the Information Service here in Geneva at the United Nations. As you all know, today, 25th of November, the international community commemorates a terrible, terrible scourge, the violence against women and girls. Today is the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women and Girls. Every 10 minutes, a woman or a girl is killed by someone she should be able to trust. Last year, 50,000 women were killed by a family member or intimate partner, 137 every single day, 137 every single day in the world. It's one of the most devastating truths of our time, and today's new 2025 UNODC UN Women Femicide Report shows that this reality has not changed in 2025. These are not isolated tragedies, tell us UN Women. They sit on a continuum of violence that too often begins with control, threats, and harassment, including online. And this year's theme for this International Day, for the 15 days that will follow of activism against gender-based violence, is exactly violence online, digital violence. So I will read you now the message of the Secretary General for this day. The Secretary General tells us, violence against women and girls is a global scourge, and in our digital age, it is being amplified by the reach and speed of technology. That is why online protection is the focus of this year's International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women and Girls. Online harassment, deepfakes, and hate speech are proliferating. Misogynistic content is moving from the margins to the mainstream. And violence that begins in the digital world can spill over into the physical in the form of stalking, abuse, even femicide. And in this crisis demands action from us all. Governments must criminalize digital violence and strengthen support for survivors. Technology companies must ensure their platforms are safe and accountable. And communities must come together in zero tolerance for online hate. We cannot allow digital spaces to be yet another place where women and girls are unsafe. On the 30th anniversary of the Beijing Declaration, I call on the world to unite to end violence against women everywhere. Together we can build a world free of fear where every woman and every girl can thrive. And to commemorate this day and to inaugurate the 15 days of activism, which, as you know, will last until 10th of December, which is Human Rights Day, we will have an event in Hall 14 today, organized together with UN Women, the EU delegation, and UNOG. And we will get together in Hall 14 to show our objection, to say no to the digital violence online. I will invite you to come and also join us on this occasion. But I've spoken about UN Women, and we have the privilege to have today with us Sophia Kaltrop, who is, as you know, the director of the UN Women Office here in Geneva, who has news on women and girls in a terrible situation, which is the situation in the Gaza Strip. Sophia, you've just come back from a trip there. Can you tell us a little bit more about the situation of women and girls there? Thank you.
Thank you, Alessandra, and good morning, everybody. So I just returned from Gaza. With our UN Women team on the ground, I traveled the entire length of the strip, from Jabali in the north to Al-Masawi in the south. We have all seen images of Gaza on our screens, but they fall far short of reality. Entire towns and neighborhoods have been reduced to rubble. Streets that once led to homes now lead to ruins. And everywhere we went, I met with women. In schools turned into shelters, in tents turned into safe spaces, and in the ruins of their own homes. I am not a woman in Gaza, and I cannot claim to know their pain, but I can carry their voices here with you today. To be a woman in Gaza today means facing hunger and fear, absorbing trauma and grief, and shielding your children from gunfire and cold nights. It means being the last line on protection in a place where safety no longer exists. It means living for a ceasefire, but not living in peace. Women in Gaza told me again and again, there may be a ceasefire, but the war is not over. The attacks are fewer, but the killings continue. Women also told me they are surviving not only a military war, but a psychological war, one they say is even harder. Every woman I met had lost at least two close family members, children, siblings, parents. We arrived in Gaza just after a weekend of severe rain and cold. Women showed me how water soaked through their makeshift tents, leaving their children shivering throughout the night. This is what it means to be a woman in Gaza today, to know that winter is coming and to know you cannot protect your children from it. Women also told me they have been displaced countless times. Every move means packing the little they have, carrying their children, their elderly parents, choosing between one unsafe place and another. One woman that I met told me she had been displaced 35 times during the war. To be a woman in Gaza today, it means to face life or death choices alone. More than 57,000 women now head their households, struggling to rebuild in the impossible. Even with a ceasefire, food is still scarce and four times more expensive, completely out of reach for women with no income. One woman told me her home was destroyed, but every morning she returns to the rubble to gather wood, burning the doors that once sheltered her family just to make breakfast for her children. That is what it means to be a woman in Gaza today. The endless bombing has left behind another crisis that we rarely speak of, but that is everywhere you go in Gaza, and that is the crisis of women and girls newly disabled by this war. Today, over 12,000 women and girls are living with long-term war-related disabilities that they did not have 2 years ago. Like this 13-year-old girl that I met, who lost her leg in a bomb attack that killed her father and her four brothers. She's been waiting for a wheelchair for months. Her life, her future, everything she once knew has been shattered by this war. This too is what it means to be a woman or a girl in Gaza today. Everywhere, women told me the same things. They need a ceasefire to hold. They need food. They need cash assistance. And they need winterization supplies, health services, and vital psychosocial support. They asked for work, for justice, for dignity, and for the restoration of their rights. They asked for their children to return to school. But what I heard from women in Gaza went far beyond survival. Everywhere, women spoke about their desire to work, to lead, and to rebuild Gaza with their own hands, and they mean it. Across from the ruins of her home, where her family is buried under the rubble, I met a woman who opened a community oven where she cooks food for others against a small fee, while looking directly at what is left of her life before the war. There is no clearer testament to the will and the power of Gaza's women to rebuild their lives. And it is in this leadership and in this resistance that we must invest now. This is exactly what UN Women is committed to do, standing with the women of Gaza today so they can lead Gaza's recovery tomorrow. UN Women has been on the ground in Gaza for more than a decade. We have stood with women and girls throughout every crisis, worked hand in hand with women-led civil society, and invested in their resilience and leadership. What it means to be a woman in Gaza today should compel us all into action, because no woman or girl should have to fight this hard just to survive. We need more aid to enter into Gaza systematically and safely, and we need the killings to stop. We need a ceasefire to hold, and we need peace. for every woman and girl, for everyone. To be a woman in Gaza today, it means holding the line between life and loss with nothing but courage and exhausted hands. And if that is what it means to be a woman in Gaza today, then it must also mean that the world cannot look away, not for one more day. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Sophia. And I will now open the floor to questions, first in the room, if any. Don't see any hand up. So let me go to the platform. I see Gabriela Sotomayor.
Yes, thank you, Alessandra. I have two questions, one for UN Women, and then for you, that you were talking about digital violence against women. My question is, what is the situation regarding in Gaza, access to food and water for women and children? Is that, you know, regularly coming for them or not? And your aid, is it free passage? Is it easy? Well, those are my questions. And then for Alessandra, do I ask the question?
Yeah, go ahead. Because ask the both.
Okay. Yeah, because there's a lot of violence against women, but especially digital violence against women journalists. So we are facing a lot of you know, violence in Twitter, in social media, and especially Mexican journalists. So if you know, the organization could have an eye on that issue in our country. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sophia, and then we'll answer.
Thank you very much. Access to food and water in Gaza is extremely scarce. I mean, we have seen a slight increase in humanitarian aid coming in, but as I mentioned, it's extremely scarce, and the markets that do exist with commodities are extremely expensive. As I said, food costs four times higher than before the war, and it's completely impossible for many of the women that I met to feed their families. As an example, an egg cost $2, which I think says something about the difficulties to access food and water in Gaza today. Thank you.
Yeah, and absolutely, Gabriela, what you said about women journalists is absolutely true. I'm sorry. I don't want to speak for you and women. Maybe you have numbers, but definitely this is something that is clear and is getting worse. I don't know the situation in Mexico. Maybe we can, Sophia will ask maybe her colleagues to say more, but definitely journalists that stop writing after having received that threats is becoming quite current. And I know that you are doing something in that. And UNESCO too. Please.
Yes. No. Thank you very much. And I can come back with concrete numbers. But as you said, Alessandra, the situation for women journalists is extremely difficult in many contexts. And actually, many countries they have laws protecting them from cyber harassment or cyber stalking, but it's less than half of the countries in the world, actually, only 40%. So that leaves 44% of the world's women and girls without access to legal protection. And I think, of course, for women journalists reporting on the difficult circumstances, this is a key issue. But happy to come back with some specific numbers on the journalists.
Thank you very much. Sophia, sorry. John Zero Costa.
Yes, good morning. Thank you, Sophia, for the briefing. I was wondering if you could give us a bit of an insight, if you had the opportunity to meet with the US State Department and Department of Defense officials who are expediting the humanitarian side in Gaza in the coming weeks through the OCHA civil military. Did you have a chance to talk to the American officials and to highlight what are the needs for women in Gaza?
Thank you. During this visit, I met with our women civil society partners on the ground, with women and girls affected by the conflict, but not with any officials.
Sorry. Thank you very much. Is there any other question for Sofia? Yes, please. Effie.
Yes, Alicia Gar from Spanish News Agency. I am wondering if you are being able to assess the specific needs of women in Gaza, if you are trying to enter sanitary pads in the strip, or if sanitary pads. Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much. No, precisely, and that was my mission, to together with our team on the ground assess the needs of women and girls and how we can scale up our protection to them. And indeed, sanitary pads is just one example of what women and girls in Gaza are completely lacking. They don't know how to wash themselves during their periods and to protect themselves. So I think that's an extremely good example on how women and girls are having specific needs and specific concerns that we very much now need to attend to. Thank you.
Nina.
Thank you, Alessandra. My question is about pregnant women. How hard is it to be pregnant and to deliver a baby in Gaza? Thank you.
Thank you very much. I mean, to deliver a baby in Gaza today, I don't think any one of us can imagine how difficult it is. I met with a woman who had lost 2 babies during her pregnancies. She had to deliver in the middle of the street while fleeing the bombs, and she lost that baby. And then a year after, she lost another baby. So the conditions for pregnant women are just unimaginable. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Oh, yes, there are more questions, sorry, online. Kuna, Imen.
Thank you so much. Just a question, actually, about women in prison, in Israeli prison, if you have any reports on that, any figures on that, especially after those 2 years of the war. Thank you so much. And the condition they are facing there. Thank you.
Thank you. So my visit was to the Gaza Strip. So I have no further information on the situation in the Israeli prison. I don't know if OHHR maybe.
Let me turn to Tamin. I don't know if you have anything on the prisons.
In fact, we are facing a big problem in accessing information about the situation of detainees in general in Israeli prisons. We have said that all those arbitrarily detained must be immediately and unconditionally freed, but we do not have specific information about the cases of those who are in detention, including, you know, the breakdown of numbers in terms of gender or age, unfortunately. Thank you.
Gabriela, you have a follow-up?
Yes, thank you very much for taking my question. I don't know how it works, but if you are sending your reports to the Corte Penal ICC Court, International Penal, I can't translate.
International Criminal Court?
Yes, exactly. If you are sending your reports to be an evidence in case one country wants to go against Israel. Thank you.
So thank you. So this mission was an assessment mission together with my UN Women colleagues on the ground, very much focusing on the needs of women and girls and how we as international community can scale up and support them in this very, very dire situation. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Thank you very much, Sofia. And before, I don't see other hands up, and before we turn to another subject, I just wanted to remind you again to join us today for the kickoff event for the 16 days of activism against gender-based violence at 12:30 at the Hall 14. Your colleague, Adriana Quiñones, will also participate in the ceremony of the lanterns that take place every year at the initiative of civil society organizations at the Ban de Paqui. That's going to be Sunday at 5 o'clock, and I think Adriana will be there together with many other activists to homage the women victims of femicide and by putting lanterns in the water. And just to explain why I'm wearing this, you may remember that in 2008, the Secretary General of the United Nations launched Unite by 2030 to End Violence Against Women. This is a long-term campaign to raise awareness on gender-based violence, and the color is orange, so that is why I have got this orange scarf, and I invite you to wear orange as a bright and optimistic color representing a future free from violence against women and girls during these 16 days. So thank you very much, Sophia, and we'll stay on the Middle East with Tamin, who's going to tell us about the increasing Israeli attacks killing civilians in Lebanon.
Thank you, Alessandra. Good morning, everyone. Almost a year since the ceasefire between Lebanon and Israel was agreed, we continue to witness increasing attacks by the Israeli military, resulting in the killing of civilians and destruction of civilian objects in Lebanon, coupled with alarming threats of a wider intensified offensive. The Israeli military's attacks have resulted in the killing of at least 127 civilians in Lebanon since the ceasefire agreement came into effect on the 27th of November 2024 and up until the 24th of November this year. In one of the latest and deadliest attacks, at least 13 civilians, including 11 children, were killed and at least 6 civilians injured last week in an Israeli strike on the Ain al-Hilwe camp for Palestinian refugees near Sidon. All the fatalities we have documented as a result of this strike were civilians, raising serious concerns that the Israeli military's attack may have violated international humanitarian law principles on the conduct of hostilities. There must be prompt and impartial investigations into the Ain al-Hilwe strike, as well as all other incidents involving possible violations of international humanitarian law by all parties, both before and after the ceasefire. Those responsible must be held to account. In addition to killing and injuring civilians, Israeli attacks in Lebanon have destroyed and damaged civilian infrastructure, including housing units, roads, factories, and construction sites. They have also severely hampered reconstruction efforts and attempts by internally displaced people to go back to their homes in southern Lebanon. For example, on the 16th of November, an Israeli strike hit a cement and asphalt factory in the town of Ansar, destroying dozens of concrete mixers, cranes, and fuel tanks. Over 64,000 people, mostly residents of southern Lebanon, remain displaced in other parts of the country. Israel started constructing a wall crossing into Lebanese territory that makes 4,000 square meters inaccessible to the population, thus affecting people's right to return to their lands. All those internally displaced must be able to go back to their homes, and reconstruction should be supported, not hampered. It is now urgent that the parties show their commitment to comply with the ceasefire in good faith. A genuine path towards a permanent cessation of hostilities is the only way to protect the human rights of civilians on both sides from the devastating effects of new hostilities. Accountability for violations of international human rights and humanitarian law must be realized. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Tamin. Thanks for this important update. Moussa,
tu parles français, hein?
Merci beaucoup, Tamir. Finalement, vous avez décidé de parler du Liban, c'est déjà très bien. J'ai quelques petites questions concernant les chiffres. Donc, vous avancez toujours, et ce n'est pas la première fois que je pose la question, vous avancez toujours des chiffres beaucoup moins que les chiffres avancés par le ministère de la Santé. Alors, vous vous basez sur quelles données pour... Parce que là, vous avez dit tout à l'heure 127. Selon les chiffres du ministre de la Santé au Liban, jusqu'à hier, 331 morts et 945 blessés. Ça, c'est d'un côté. De l'autre côté, hier aussi, il y a eu une attaque contre le banlieue sud du Liban. Je ne sais pas si vous avez mentionné ça dans votre rapport. Il me semble que là, donc, les chiffres que vous avancez, le 127, ça, c'est les vous nommez les civils. Mais le reste, je ne sais pas si, parce que ce sont des combattants de Hezbollah, vous ne les mentionnez pas, parce qu'ils ne sont pas mentionnés par, donc, je sais pas, par vos rapports plusieurs reprises. Et là, j'aimerais bien savoir, ces combattants, en cas de... donc, il n'y a pas un front aujourd'hui. Il n'y a pas un combat entre le Liban et l'Israël. Est-ce que on ne peut pas les compter parmi les civils ou pas? J'aimerais bien clarifier cette chose de votre part. Merci.
Merci beaucoup, Moussa. Question assez compliquée, très intéressante et importante. Par rapport aux civils et aux chiffres que nous avançons aujourd'hui, ce qui nous intéresse en tant que Haut Commissariat aux droits de l'homme, ce sont les civils. Donc, on est évidemment au courant et on voit les chiffres qui sont avancés par les autorités libanaises. J'imagine que ces chiffres-là comprennent les civils et les combattants. En tout cas, nous ne voyons pas de distinction. Les chiffres que nous avançons aujourd'hui, les 127 civils, ce sont des personnes civiles qui ont été tuées depuis le cessez-le-feu et dont nous avons réussi à vérifier le fait qu'ils ont été tués selon notre méthodologie. Ça veut dire que, voilà, c'est ce qu'on a réussi à vérifier en termes de victimes civiles. Il peut évidemment y avoir d'autres personnes, y compris des civils, qui ont été tués, mais que nous n'avons pas encore réussi à vérifier selon notre méthodologie qui est très, très stricte et qui demande un certain niveau de vérification. Et comme vous le savez, que ce soit au Liban ou dans d'autres conflits au monde, notre méthode de vérification prend du temps. Donc, au fur et à mesure des mois, je pense que nous allons arriver à un chiffre qui se rapproche un peu plus de la réalité du nombre de ceux qui ont été tués, et je parle des civils, évidemment. En ce qui concerne les combattants, évidemment, les règles sont très strictes, et le droit international humanitaire stipule que une personne qui est dans une attaque imminente peut être objet d'une attaque, mais aujourd'hui, ce qu'on dit, c'est qu'il faut respecter le cessez-le-feu. Et ça, c'est ce qui est nécessaire aujourd'hui pour que les deux pays puissent avancer et que la reconstruction puisse recommencer au Liban. Mais voilà, ça, c'est ce qui concerne les civils, évidemment.
Là, je me base sur le droit international, les traités de Genève. Un combattant ou même une armée qui n'est pas au front, il est civil. Donc, c'est ce que les lois disent. Maintenant, vous parlez, vous dites qu'un combattant, donc c'est comme si je comprends, on peut le tuer parce qu'il est un combattant, même s'il est dans sa famille, comme c'est ce qui s'est passé hier. Donc là, il faut vraiment clarifier. Est-ce que vous vous basez sur les documents de Genève, le droit international, ou bien sur d'autres bases? Parce que selon Israël, elle dit, voilà, j'ai tué telle et telle personne qui sont le Hezbollah. Donc, le reste, elles sont fous. Et là, je ne sais pas si on se base sur les données d'Israël pour distinguer entre les civils et les non-civils. Et surtout, maintenant, je dois répéter vraiment ça, parce que c'est vraiment très une histoire à ne pas tenir debout, les gens qui ne sont pas au front, qui ne sont pas militaires, et vous pouvez donc se baser sur le rapport de l'UNIFEL. Depuis le cessez-le-feu jusqu'à aujourd'hui, il y a 2750 violations du cessez-le-feu de la part d'Israël, il y a zéro de la part du Liban. Et là, vous dites que ceux-là peuvent être combattants, donc on ne peut pas compter avec les civils. Et encore une chose, à Gaza, vous vous basez sur les chiffres avancés par le ministère de la Santé. Pourquoi au Liban, vous ne vous basez pas sur les chiffres du ministère de la Santé au Liban? Merci.
Merci pour ça. Tout d'abord, nous, on est en train de compter les civils. Alors, les chiffres qu'on avance, ce sont les personnes dont on est sûr que ce sont des civils. Comme par exemple, les 13 personnes qui ont été tuées à Ain el-Helwe, dont 11 enfants. Aujourd'hui, maintenant, en ce qui concerne les combattants, il peut y avoir quelqu'un qui est sur le front et qui est un combattant, mais il peut y avoir quelqu'un qui est dans une activité, qui est dans une préparation d'une hostilité, mais qui n'est pas physiquement sur le front. Mais le plus important pour moi, c'est que nous regardons toutes les personnes qui ont été tuées au Liban. Et nous regardons tous les cas. Et nous avons une procédure de vérification qui est toujours en cours. Donc, parfois, on peut avoir un doute sur un cas. On peut penser que cette personne peut considérer comme un combattant, mais on se rend compte que non, finalement, cette personne, on peut la compter parmi les civils. Et lorsque cette vérification est complète, et que le doute est levé, la personne ou le cas peut être compté parmi les civils. En ce qui concerne, par exemple, la comparaison que vous avez faite avec Gaza, nous n'avons pas le même accès à Gaza que celui qu'on a au Liban. Donc, à Gaza, ce qu'on dit toujours, c'est que les chiffres qu'on regarde, on le dit toujours, ce sont les chiffres des autorités de santé à Gaza. Il se trouve qu'au Liban, on a un peu plus les moyens de vérifier que les morts sont, si les morts sont civils ou pas. Donc, on préfère vous donner les chiffres dont on est encore plus sûr qui correspondent à notre vérification, parce qu'on a une vérification. Je peux vous dire qu'à Gaza aussi, évidemment, le nombre de personnes qui ont été tuées est beaucoup plus élevé. Donc, on a une procédure de vérification qui est toujours en cours. Mais ça prend encore plus de temps et ça prendra encore plus de temps pour atteindre la vérification totale de toutes ces personnes qui ont été tuées à Gaza.
Gabriela, bref. Après, vous pouvez prendre après vous avec Tamina.
Tamine, je suis désolé, mais là, je dois envoyer avec vous les conventions de Genève aux commissions de droits de l'homme pour les lire de nouveau, parce que là, ce n'est pas vraiment très clair ce que vous dites. Là, pour moi, ce n'est pas tellement une histoire de vérification, parce que vous dites qu'il y a des morts qui sont civils et il y a des morts qui ne sont pas, peut-être pas civils. Et là, je dois vous demander vraiment de se baser sur les conventions de Genève pour voir qui est civil et qui n'est pas civil. Merci beaucoup.
Alors, nos collègues, quand ils font leur vérification et qu'ils nous fournissent ces chiffres, se basent sur le droit international pour décider qui est civil et qui n'est pas civil. Évidemment, la base, c'est le droit international humanitaire.
Merci, Tamine. Gabriel.
Yes, thank you for taking my question. I would like to know if you have a comment on freedom of expression in the United States. The President Trump said that he threatened journalists who says questions against him or criticize him or something like that. And then he called Miss Piggy to one of the journalists that asked a question. So if you have something to say on that issue, thank you so much.
I mean, you want to answer this now, or because you still have one item, you want to answer this now? Okay, go ahead, and then we go to Nigeria.
Freedom of the press and freedom of expression must be respected anywhere, everywhere. Any response to any allegations against journalists must be handled through proportionate response and fully consistent with the particular importance the international human rights law places on freedom of expression in all matters of major public interest. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And stay here, please, Tamin, because I don't see other questions on that, but we are now going to another important situation that... Ah, pardon, excusez-moi, Alexandre, je vous avais pas vu.
No worries. Thank you for taking my question. No, we were just wondering, you're calling for an investigation in Lebanon. Who, according to you, should make that investigation?
The state of Israel and the Israeli military is responsible for its actions. So when we're talking about strikes conducted by the Israeli military, the Israeli military should investigate its own actions, and there should be accountability for all violations that happen. Of course, the Lebanese state has the responsibility to investigate similar violations that can occur from its side. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Have I forgotten any hand? No? Okay, so let's move now to Nigeria, also with Tamin, but we also have online Chilael, who is the World Food Programme Communications Officer in Nigeria. I think you are connecting from Abuja, Chi. Both of you would like to speak about the situation in Nigeria. Tamin, you wanted to comment the mass abductions that we have seen recently in the country, while Chi will tell us about the surging instability in Nigeria that is driving hunger to unprecedented levels. So maybe I'll start with you, Tamin, and then we'll go to Chi. Thank you.
Thank you. We are shocked at the recent surge in mass abductions in north-central Nigeria. We urge the Nigerian authorities at all levels to take all lawful measures to ensure such vile attacks are halted and those responsible are held to account. At least 402 people, most of them school children, have been abducted in the states of Niger, Kebbi, Kwara, and Borno since the 17th of November. Only 88 of them have reportedly been freed or have escaped from their captors. We call on the Nigerian authorities to ensure the safe return of all those still in captivity to their families and to prevent further abductions. They must also hold prompt, impartial, and effective investigations into these abductions and bring those responsible to justice. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Chi?
Good morning, everyone. So Nigeria has released the latest Kadra Harmonize, its food security analysis, and it shows a rapidly worsening situation across the country, particularly in the northern Nigeria, where we've seen an increase in insurgent attacks. It's this instability that's driving hunger to levels that Nigeria has never experienced before. Nearly 35 million people could face food insecurity in the next 6 months. That would be the highest number recorded in the country and the highest on the continent. Throughout this year, attacks by insurgent groups have intensified. Just last month, Nigeria witnessed what was reportedly the first attack by JNIM, an Al-Qaeda-affiliated group. At the same time, ESWAP continues to expand its presence across the north and the wider Sahel. Most recently, a soldier was killed in the northeast, while in the north central and northwest regions, two schools were attacked, children kidnapped in the same week. These incidents illustrate a clear and deeply worrying trend. Communities are under severe pressure from repeated attacks and economic stress. Families are being pushed to the edge, and the need for support is rising. Northeast Nigeria, where WFP operates, is now facing its most severe hunger crisis in a decade. Rural farming communities are among the hardest hit. Nearly 6 million people are food insecure in the conflict zones of Borno, Adamawa, and Yobe states. In Borno alone, 15,000 people are projected to reach catastrophic conditions. Women and children are once again at the greatest risk of severe malnutrition, but funding cuts have forced us to scale down nutrition programs since July, affecting more than 300,000 children. We found that where clinics closed, malnutrition levels worsened from serious to critical within months. Almost 1 million people depend on WFP to survive. Food and nutrition assistance remain one of the few stabilizing forces in northern Nigeria. Without it, there is a real concern that insurgent groups could exploit people's hunger and desperation to strengthen their own influence, creating a security threat that extends far beyond Nigeria's borders. The dire situation has been compounded by funding shortfalls that diminish WFP's ability to provide life-saving assistance. We have to point out that WFP will run out of resources for emergency food assistance in December, in a few weeks' time. Without confirmed funding, millions will be left without support next year. The consequences for stability, for security, and for human life will be severe.
Thank you very much. Yep, thank you very much. So I'll open now the floor to question on Nigeria. In the room? No? Online? Nick Cumming-Bruce, she is our correspondent of the New York Times. Nick, you have the floor.
Yeah, thank you. I just wonder if she could give some numbers in relation to what WFP has been spending in Nigeria and what it needs to meet the crisis in the north and what your forecasts are for 2026. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. So WFP requires about $115 million for the next 6 months. That will take us up to May 2026. That will be the beginning of the lean season when people's ability to feed themselves will drastically diminish. This year, we've raised about $150 million. It's why in July we sort of rang the alarm to tell everyone that we were running out of funding because it just wasn't enough to meet the needs. For the last 2 to 3 years, the scale of the needs and our resources just haven't kept pace. And so we're constantly finding that while the needs are growing, the funding we have to support people is much lower than what's required. Already we are concerned that by January, we won't be able to provide assistance to the 900,000 people we've been assisting in November, December, October, and that we may have to reduce either the ration sizes or reduce the number of people we assist to just 450,000 people. That is a drop in the ocean compared to the 6 million people who really need assistance, who rely on WFP for food, for nutrition. Apart from just letting everyone know that the hunger situation is getting worse, we really need people to know that resources are required immediately if we're going to be able to help people in the next few weeks.
Thank you very much. Let me see if there are other questions for you, Emma, Reuters, Emma Farge, or to Tamin, I don't know.
No, it's on Nigeria, thanks. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about what you meant when you said there's a concern that insurgent groups could exploit people's hunger to strengthen their own influence. Are you already seeing that happening? Have people told you about that? And how could that pan out in the months ahead? Thank you.
So a few months ago, some of the northern governors raised concerns that in their states, young people were being recruited for as little as 30 to 50 cents per day, recruited because they were giving young people money to buy food, which they didn't have on their own. And so what we're saying is that if it costs as little as 30 to 50 cents to recruit a young person, as soon as you take away food assistance, it is so easy or that much easier for alternative or sort of bad actors to come in and take root, because what's needed to turn somebody is so small. Right now, people are desperate for 30 to 50 cents a day just to survive. If we had money to provide food assistance, that would keep people out of harm's way. It would ensure that people were engaged in WFP activities or the wider humanitarian program. But in the absence of humanitarian assistance, the fear is that other actors or other forces could take place.
Thank you very much. Efe, you had your hand up. Yep.
Yes, Alicia Gar from Spanish News Agency. Do you have any information of which could be the groups that are behind these mass abductions?
Do you mind to just step a little bit farther from your camera, because we don't have your whole image. Sorry. Yeah, I'm told by the régie. Okay, go ahead if you can answer. Or you wanna add something? No? Okay, go ahead.
I don't know if this question is for me or for our colleague in the room. This is about the abductions.
Maybe Tamin?
Yes,
Tamin, then?
We know that we have seen reports that there are groups acting to abduct people for ransom. We are not sure about the identities of these groups for now. We are continuing to follow the situation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other question? Lara.
Yes. When you say that it can be the worst food crisis in Nigeria, you mean also compared to Biafra crisis?
That's a good question. So if we take the civil war, that was a 2.5-year war, 1967 to 1971. That was different. It was very short. And in that time, 2 to 3 million people died of starvation that we know. That was 2 to 3 million people died in that war. What we're saying today is that in Nigeria, 35 million people face severe hunger in the next 6 months. And that means that they have 1, maybe 2 months worth of food supplies left. It means that they have exhausted all their other usual mechanisms of sourcing food, borrowing from people, taking on extra jobs. Typically now those extra jobs aren't available. The people they would borrow from are also out of money. And so they really don't have many places or many ways to make money or to buy food. So this is very different from the Nigerian Civil War. That was something specific to the Southeast region. This latest report looks at the entire country and is reporting on what is happening in 27 of the states, including the federal capital. And what we're seeing here is that in conflict zones today, particularly in the Northwest and in the Northeast, hunger is rising at a rapid scale. And if we look back a year ago, there were 5 million people hungry in the Northeast. Today, it's 6 million. If we look at the Northwest, today, 6 million people are food insecure. A year ago, it was 5 million. So we can see that this number is rapidly rising, and it's having an impact on the entire country, because the northern part of the country was the breadbasket. It's where most of the food was grown that fed the entire population. And now with all of these attacks, the resurgence of groups, we're seeing that people can't go to farm. They're either too afraid or their farms have been taken over. And so if the region that is supposed to grow the food isn't, it affects the entire country. And so you see right across Nigeria, places that depended on the north for the staple crops, they just don't have them. And so people are out of jobs, but they're also out of the food that they survived on. Many people think of Nigeria, and there are a few capitals that come to mind, but actually 70% of the population are farmers. They're into agriculture. But most of those people are in the north, and most of those people are in regions that are facing daily attacks. And so farming is no longer an option, which means they don't have a means to feed themselves, but they also don't have a means to feed the rest of the country.
Thank you very much. No more hands up. So thanks a lot, Chief, for this. Sorry. Is that for to her? Okay. I'd like to free Chi now. Thanks so much for telling us more about the situation, food in Nigeria. Mohammed, but is that for Tamin? Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Thank you so much.
Chi. You can stay if you want, but I think we'll go to another subject now. Okay. Mohammed?
Thank you so much, Alessandra. As you know, on Sunday there was a Ukraine peace talks in Geneva, and my question is, was any UN officials a part of these talks, or was the United Nations briefed on these talks or this plan after this meeting? Thank you.
The short answer is no. No. These talks were, as you know, between delegations, and we were not involved in the discussion. The answer is no for the moment. But of course, if there is anything that changed on that, we will let you know. Any other question for me? If not, please stay tuned, because I have a few announcements for you, and then an important announcement. So let's go to the announcement of the press conferences. Just to be reminded that today at 2 p.m. you will have the press conference of UNAIDS with Winnie Bianima, the executive director, who will be physically here in the press room to present you the World AIDS Day 2025, Overcoming Disruption, Transforming the AIDS Response Report. That's for the 1st of December, International Day, World AIDS Day. I think this is the right name. On the 1st of December, Monday at 9:30, UNIDIR will launch the Landmine Monitor 2025 report together with the three members of the impact team that prepares the Landmine Monitor report. On behalf of UNESCO, I'm asked to inform you that on the 27th of November from 10 to 12:30, the UNESCO Liaison Office will host the event titled UNESCO from Santiago to Geneva, Advancing Inclusive Sport and Physical Education. That's going to be at the Restaurant Vieux-Bois. You're all invited to join this event, which will bring together experts in the field of sports and physical education to explore strategies and best practices for fostering more inclusive and accessible sporting environments. You have to register in order to go there to the link that that is provided in the press briefing document that UNESCO has sent you. Of course, I don't forget the meeting updates of the committees. So the Committee Against Torture is going to close its 83rd session on Friday and will issue the concluding observation of the reports of the four countries they reviewed, which were Israel, Argentina, Bahrain, and Albania. The Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination is concluding this morning the review of the report of Burundi, which will be followed by New Zealand, Tunisia, and then on the 4th of December, the committee will celebrate the 60th anniversary of the convention, which was adopted in December 1965. And then, finally, just an invitation to you all. As you know, the 29th of November, the international community commemorates the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. This year it comes on a Saturday. So the UN office at Geneva invites you to the observance of this International Day on Friday, 28th of November at 3 p.m. There will be the commemoration in room 12 of the Palais des Nations. This will be webcast, and it will see the participation of the Director General of UNOG, Mrs. Tatiana Balovaya, together with representatives of many of our member states. And this concludes my announcements, formal announcements, usual announcements, but we have a very special announcement and a little bit sad one too. I'd like to ask Liz to come to the podium. Liz, come here, please. We just would like to have you one last time on the podium, Liz, on this podium, and the old ones, because you have been here for such a long time that you know that you've known the other press rooms, room 3 and the other rooms. And I'd like to welcome Liz Trossel, that I don't need to introduce to you, of course, one of the pillars of the communication system in Geneva, and of course, one of the most important voices for the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. Liz, you've been with us so much time, I can't even remember. It doesn't make us any younger. But I would like to really thank you very, very much on behalf of all the community here in Geneva, the journalists, unis, I think all also the colleagues, spokesperson, and I see a few here, for the incredible work you have done. You have brought the voice of not only the office, but in general of the human rights loud and far and around the world. I can't even count the number of videos that we have clipped of you that have done incredible numbers on social media. You've been really a fantastic colleague, and I would really like to thank you on behalf of all the communication community here in Geneva. And before we clap, I know that the journalists also want to say something to you. So maybe Emma, I'll give you the floor on behalf of Acano.
Hey, good morning, Liz. Just to say thank you so much for being available for us all these years. You've always been very reactive and very articulate. So thank you for your contribution to our work.
Thank you very much, and maybe now we can clap. Thank you. But you have the word. I give the floor, and that's unfortunately will be probably the last time. But I just think you have a right of response.
It's everybody's nightmare. You know, when you're a radio journalist, you have nightmares that you're going into the studio and you don't have your news bulletin to read out. And I'm now being expected to brief without any briefing notes. I'll keep it brief. You saying how many years? They've absolutely flown by. But for those of you, old timers, and I think I can say as now sort of an officially old person, there are some old timers in the press corps and around. I actually washed up in Geneva in April 2013 as the first ever media officer for the treaty bodies. And I was, you know, the fact that you read out the announcement of the treaty bodies, I mean, they are so important. Some of you might remember we used to have our press conferences mainly in press room 1. That was a hoot with a lot of the committees. So many memories. You said you spoke about the press briefing rooms. I kind of miss press briefing room 3. Then there were the kind of the smaller rooms that we had to go into.
The library
that was really, really hot. And now, of course, this bespoke state-of-the-art briefing room. I have really had an amazing 12 and a half years. Both as a media officer for the treaty bodies, doing a little time at World Health Organization. Obviously, my time with the wonderful colleagues from Refugees. Hi, Baba. Happy Tuesday. And, of course, with the wonderful colleagues from UN Human Rights. I really want to pay tribute to the coverage that you give to human rights, to the questions you ask, well, most of them. And, you know, I really cannot stress how important the work is of Eunice, of the spokespeople, and of course you, the journalists who cover us. I'm going away. I will possibly follow every now and then what you're doing here. I go away with the fondest of memories. I've learned so much from you, from fellow spokespeople. It's been an absolute honor and privilege, and thank you so much for your kind words.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. These are moments where you feel, you know, so bittersweet because you've been fantastic and we really have been fantastically happy to be with you. Bitter because we see another old time going and we feel sorry. But I'm pretty sure, as you said, journalist or spokesperson one day, journalist or spokesperson the rest of your life, I'm pretty sure you will continue to follow us and don't hesitate to come and say hello from time to time. Thank you very much to you all for having followed this press briefing. Thanks again, Liz, for your fantastic contribution. And I'll see you on Friday. Thank you.